Great trial lawyers are made, not born. Welcome to Verdict Academy, preserving trial wisdom for trial lawyers. Join host Kevin Morrison, trial attorney in San Francisco, as he recreates those invaluable hallway conversations that remote work has made rare. Candid insights and hard-won lessons from America's most accomplished trial lawyers. Produced and powered by Law Pods.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Verdict Academy, where we bring you the best trial lawyers in the country to share their top three trial tips. When you've reached the apex of your profession, do you rest on your laurels? Or do you continue to use your abilities to serve and mentor others? Our guest today, Rich Schoenberger, a plaintiff's trial attorney at the Walkup Law Firm in San Francisco, chose the latter and continues to try cases and mentor aspiring trial lawyers. I'd be here all day describing the achievements of Rich's 40-year legal career, but let me take a minute to outline some of the highlights. Rich is a Bay Area native, graduated from Santa Clara for undergrad and UC Law San Francisco, formerly Hastings, for his law degree. After graduation, he spent 2 years as an assistant district attorney and quickly rose to prosecuting serious felony cases. In 1987, he joined Walkup and became a partner in 1995. Rich's courtroom successes are too numerous to mention, but his most recent one, just a few months ago, is noteworthy. He and his team at Walkup, including his law partner, Andrew McDevitt, obtained a $26 million verdict in a complex products case for a man paralyzed after an off-road vehicle overturned. The Orange County jury concluded that the Yamaha rollover protection system was defectively designed, knew it was defectively designed before the incident, and failed to recall it, thereby causing these life-changing injuries. When Rich is not trying cases, he's mentoring others in NIDA, ABOTA, and other organizations. Rich is a member of the Big Four Invitation-Only Trial Organizations, ACTL, ISOB, IATL, and ABOTA. He served as the ABOTA San Francisco Chapter President, has received the chapter's highest honor, its Don Bailey Civility and Professionalism Award, and has spearheaded the chapter's flash trial competition, which allows younger attorneys to gain experience in a courtroom with live witnesses and judges. Rich Schoenberger, welcome to Verdict Academy, my friend.
Thank you. As you were saying all that, I realized that I'm also in the WGASAM, which is the Who Gives a Shit About Me group of lawyers, and I am a proud member. I was inducted several years ago.
Fantastic. You serve as president of the organization as well?
Yes, I am.
All right. In all seriousness, you're just at the top of your profession, and I consider you a very good friend. What drew you to become a courtroom lawyer?
That story, it's funny, kind of begins and ends with a very sad time in my life, but formative, which was in my second year at then Hastings, a classically mediocre student. My dad was diagnosed with cancer. He was 53. He died within 37 days. And we got a chance to talk a lot about what I wanted to be and do. And I wasn't sure, but I felt like there was something about trial work that called to me, being a trial lawyer or an actor, because I was sort of a ham. I have a face for radio, and I thought, man, that's probably not going to work. And this concept of trial work that I had just started to be exposed to in law school, I found very attractive. Don't have any lawyers in the family, etc. And I remember he said, what's the best place to learn how to be a trial lawyer? And I said, I have no idea. And he said, well, why don't you find out? And I did, and asked around a bunch, and a bunch of different sources kept saying Alameda County DA's office. That's the place where you will learn to cut your teeth trying cases. You'll try a lot of cases. The crime is real and unambiguous, and the training program is fantastic. I was sort of too late for that training program, but while she was teaching advocacy at Hastings, and would just hang out after her class and say, I want an interview. And eventually got one. And that whole story was fascinating. But that's what got me going. And I kind of haven't looked back since, in that I have never questioned whether it was right for me. I sort of had no idea and didn't think about it up to then. And then it was my bliss, as James Campbell would say. I followed my bliss, and it's been my bliss.
So it wasn't like you went to law school, I want to be a trial attorney, but you got a taste for it. And your dad kind of helped you in those 37 days. It must have been incredible and horrible, but incredible. He encouraged you to explore that. And then once you had a taste of it, you were sold.
Sold.
Yeah. Got it.
Yeah. Really great. Really, really fun to have that feeling. I wish that for everyone in whatever they choose, that they have that, I guess you'd call it passion. But for me, trial work wasn't what I wanted to do. It's what I need to do.
You can't believe you get paid for it.
Yeah, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Okay. Well, the format of the program is to give younger or less experienced trial lawyers trial tips from the masters, and three of them. I'm a big rule of three guy. And so you're going to help us give us three tips to our aspiring lawyers out there. And tip number one discusses the general area of closing. Have it done before you open the trial. Talk to us about closing argument, Rich.
You know, you can kid yourself into thinking that your case is going to be won and lost in this dramatic closing argument. And there are times when done right, I think when the trial is done right, closing argument can serve the purpose of putting it all together. Because, for example, on cross-examination, where you're resisting asking the so question, you're eliciting the one fact per question testimony that you want. The witness is a bobblehead on the stand saying yes or no. And you've gotten those facts that you're going to use in closing argument. You get to use it in closing argument. But what I mean by having your closing argument done before you even start the trial, and I'm not Pollyannish enough to think that it's really, really done, but that there is the skeletal outline of your closing argument completed, because then there's a means to an end. Every single thing you're doing in trial is toward that end. And if it doesn't meet that end, then you don't ask the question. And that's been a really helpful tool for me. I need to know, I've got my jury instructions, I've done my good facts, bad facts analysis, I have my theory, I have my theme, and within the context of my closing argument, every witness and the order of the witnesses and all of those things are driven by where I want to go at the end and how best to know where you want to go at the end than knowing that at the beginning. So while a closing argument has this reputation of being fire and brimstone, and where you actually argue and where you use rhetoric and where you use analogies within the concept of rhetoric and silence and some emotion when appropriate and even disdain and rebuttal when it's earned, that stuff is very important for the close. But the substance of the close is, I think, vitally important before you get started.
Do you use the verdict form to outline your argument, and do you go over the verdict form in closing?
Not only do I use it, I typically am a big fan of, in this world of high tech, having a fair amount of low tech in the courtroom, almost surrounded by things. One of those things is an overblown verdict form.
Poster board,
big marker.
And you go over and mark the answers yourself?
Absolutely. And even at times, depending on the case and depending on the jury, filling in the amount of the appropriate damages, what I think is fair. Other times, very sophisticated jury with hundreds of years of experience, not wanting to deign to do that for them, but having suggestions, but inviting them to do that. My favorite way of using the special verdict form as a guidepost for closing argument, and this is, you know, the offensive part of why we win, question number two, why we win causation, keep going, then getting into their defenses and comparative negligence, which seems to always exist in virtually every case I try, and then apportionment, I think is the biggest advantage that we have as plaintiff's lawyers. It is an enormous advantage where we get to be reasonable and institutionally and legally they can't. It's a horrible problem and predicament for a defense attorney in a big economic damages case where 1% applies to have to say we did nothing wrong. And I love to, again, in low tech, and Kevin, you and I have probably talked about this thermometer thing that I've done for, I don't know, the last six cases I've tried, I think, where I'm always looking for Rodney Jew's single point of failure going back in time, having a thermometer, having our event of the that leads us there at the top of the thermometer, one of those fundraising thermometers, and then filling it with the defendant's negligence or fault products case that predates the event itself, leaving just a little room at the top for fault with respect to the event, such that even if there is comparative, I argue both temporally and visually that most of the thermometer is already filled with their fault. So if you want to give them 50-50 for that day, there's only 10% left. 90% of it's already been filled. And that is a part of and a companion to the special verdict form that are both low tech instead of, you know, fancy pants PowerPoint, which has its place if used properly. But those are the two big low-tech items I like to use in close.
Two questions on closing. One, is it your theory that you can win the case in closing by swaying the jury? Or is it your job to give nice tidbits to jurors who are going to fight for you for the verdict or something else?
I am always talking to my jurors, whom I have speculated are my jurors by virtue of their body language throughout and who they were when jury was selected. And I'm admonishing gently for, you know, if you're in the jury room and someone says X, remind them of Y. That's a really important part. I think that just like an opening statement, you have to trust their intelligence and not get so detailed about everything. But I do think that closing argument is important when you've been disciplined in your cross-examination to put it all together. Remember when I asked this question? Remember when so-and-so said this? Here's why that matters. And that's, I think, an important part of letting them know why you were doing the things that you were doing, as opposed to getting into the mud with them, because it's safer. It's safer when you're in the mud in cross-examination and you're saying, so what you're saying is, then you get in return, no, that's not what I'm saying at all, and you've lost control. So I think that a well-executed cross-examination does cry out for explanation in closing argument that even the smartest jurors may not have picked up on because they're not in your head. You obviously want to be obvious in cross why you're doing what you're doing, but sometimes it just needs a little explanation.
Second question, rebuttal is a part of closing. What is your plan going in for rebuttal?
To rebut and to have it also anticipated somewhat.
Yeah, sorry to interrupt. You know, like, the discovery, we know what they're going to say, right? And so do you have, okay, I know they're going to say comparative, and this is why I'm doing a rebuttal, or is it something else?
It's something else because you have to be facile enough within the context of what they're saying in close. Like, for example, where you might be setting it up is if you're going to ask rhetorical questions.
Do you do that?
Sometimes. Depends on not just the facts, but it depends on the lawyer. Who will bite and who won't? And if I know someone will bite, then I will. And then if they don't, I'll call them on it. And if they do, they bit. And then I get to feed off of that. But as far as a well-organized rebuttal, I think it is much like a well-organized cross. It should start strong. It should end strong. There should be, with everything we do, a sit-down line. And so the importance of organization in a rebuttal is that you're going to start strong and you're going to end strong. you're looking for gifts that they gave you during closing argument. That's something that I'm really paying attention to. You're looking for promises that they made in opening statement. That's something that is going to be written in by the time you get there because they broke that promise. And you're looking for transition from one to another so that it isn't this disjointed blob, but rather smoothly makes a transition from one point to another. Short is better. I remember once in a case that the arguments went from like 8:30 to 11:45. And I was ready to go at 11:45. And I could have had a half hour, 45 minute rebuttal easily. But it had been a relatively long trial. And I think building in contrast is important. And I thought their closing argument went too long. And so I said, it's 11:45. If I promise to be done at noon, will you promise to listen to me until then? Then that means you're done at noon. There's no 12:02 or 12:01.
Got their attention, though. You got their attention.
Yeah, and everything you said had to matter. In this last case, Andy McDevitt and I sat up. We got an enormous gift in that my argument started 10, and I think it was the longest closing argument I've ever given. It was 2 hours, but it had been a 9-week trial, and I did not like that. And I told them that. I said, it's been 4 or 5 weeks since you've heard anything we had to say in our case. And I need to tell you, I do not want to talk for the next 2 hours. And if I don't want to talk for the next 2 hours, I know you don't want to hear me for the next 2 hours. But I'm hopeful you'll take this journey with me. And I'm hopeful that I don't believe I'll be wasting your time. But I finished after lunch. He could have finished at 4. And if he'd have finished at 4, this judge was it was the hardest judge I've ever tried a case in front of for a whole lot of reasons. If he'd have finished at 4 and she was going to give me a half hour or 20 minutes to a half hour, I would have had to go then. It would have been okay. But he went till 4:20 and she did not force, and she was done at 4:30. And she barely said, I could tell, I could see the wheels turning, we'll come back tomorrow. You can do your rebuttal. You'll have 20 minutes. And she had given me 30 previously. I think I took 25 and she was fine with it. But I'm telling you, because we had that night, it was the cleanest rebuttal I've ever gotten to give. The luxury of that. And I mean, and stayed up till midnight. I mean, it was long and we edited and then we got rid of stuff that didn't matter. And then we made it matter. You know, it was important. And by the way, it was the only thing they heard that day before they're getting instructions. It was like, oh God, that was lucky. That, I will say this, Kevin, of all of the trials, and I'm not kidding myself into thinking that our closing arguments matter that much, I actually think that rebuttal mattered, which I think that's the exception in my trials.
Next topic, jury selection. Why is it so important and how should you do it?
So you hear people talk about rehearsing opening statement and getting that down pat. And I think that's right. You know, not so pat that it sounds rote or robotic, but such that you are comfortable enough to have your outline and to be telling a story with eyes on your jury, even if that means going back to your outline occasionally, but just comfortable enough to be exposed. And so people practice it. If that's true, an opening statement, you know, they say people have had their mind up 85% of them after opening statement. I don't know if that's true or not, but I will tell you this. If you don't have the right jury, it doesn't matter how good your opening statement's going to be. You're going to lose, plain and simple. And I think wise people say the most important part about any trial is jury selection, 100%. Well, if that's true, then why are people not practicing it? You know, they say it's the most important part. Let me get a consultant. Well, your jury selection is usually coming down to a couple of people, right? There's some obvious people you can't have, and there's some obvious people you love. Your job is to prehab them and not expose them with your questions with respect to those whom you don't want. You got two choices. You either have to use a challenge on them or you get them for cause. Well, how do you get them for cause? That's a whole exercise. You know, you have to go into the trial knowing where are your vulnerabilities. What are your, I call it my worry basket. What is your worry basket? I empty my worry basket jury selection. How do I know how to empty my worry basket? How do I know how to ask the right question? How do I know to have that muscle memory with a unique set of facts, because every case is unique, without practicing. So I will never try a case without practicing jury selection. It sounds strange, but you are in there asking those questions that are unique to your case, getting answers, and it could be 12 people in your office. It could be 9 people. It could be 6 people. It could be something where you're spending an hour, hour and a half just building up that ability to flow from these unique topics, one to another, to get the bad answer, to reward them for the bad answer so that you get the candor from them, which frees other people to be candid, which allows you to get into your world of transitioning from listening, which should be 90% of it, to leading questions, to, for me, asking the question in an unoffensive or non-offensive way that begins with, as you're moving forward and you're welcoming and your arms are open. So a case like this, it's fair to say it's hard for you to be entirely impartial. And there's nothing threatening about that sentence, but those words are in the civil code. And once they say they can't be entirely impartial, they are a cause challenge. How you get there and in a particular case type takes practice. And for people who've done it a lot, always learning, always trying to get better at jury selection, always listening to how other people do it. There's so many people who are so good at it, but it's everything. You know, the sick feeling that you have when you're like, shit, there's 4 bad people on this jury, and that's on me.
Well, sometimes yes, sometimes no. Sometimes the folks who show up for that day are, you know, it just is, you know?
100%. And the case that Craig and I tried it in, that was one of them. We were never going to win that case, but doesn't mean you don't try.
Yeah. You could fake a medical emergency. Rich, did you consider that?
I have. I've gotten gassy, which cleared the room. And that was helpful.
Yes.
But it was only temporary. So I gotta go back to the drawing board.
The joke I have on jury selection is once the jury's sworn, they turn to whoever I'm trying the case is, okay, case is over. I'll catch you guys for closing. I mean, right? Kind of right. I guess the evidence part matters, but we know what the evidence is. We know what their evidence is. And I 100% agree with you. And I started.
And I know you agree, Kevin. All we're looking for is a fair jury.
100%. Because your case is good enough. You're going to win with a fair jury, but you're not going to win with someone who's got an agenda or life experiences that are going to help you out. Yeah, 100%.
Exactly. So we don't need to gild the lily.
No.
Just want a fair jury, an open mind jury.
I love the practice jury selection. I can tell you the last 3 trials, I do a full-on mock opening and jury selection the weekend before trial. It is incredible. It is a pain in the ass because all the minutia is going full bore there, right? You got the motions, you got this, the drama, the craziness of pretrial. But to your point, if it's the most important part of trial and everybody agrees, why aren't you spending your time on it? There's nothing more important. So when I only try 1 case a year, maybe 1 case every 2 years. I need to get the rust off, man. And so I'm not getting the rust off in my actual trial. I'm getting the rust off the week before with, 15 people who whatever. And I just, it's so, yeah, it costs some money. How much does a crap jury cost? So you got to do it.
You make a great point, a couple of great points. The feeling of ease that you have, because we don't try more than 1 or 2 a year, the feeling that you have when you just did it the week before, it's so much better than going in cold.
And you've heard words that the actual jurors are going to use and you know how to respond.
Yeah. No, I highly recommend it.
All right. 3rd and final, cut your case down and then divide in half.
Yeah. Listen, man, I'm a big offender, but I'm not obsessive by personality, which is a blessing and a curse probably. But I do believe, asked by bride, I do say to myself and believe that perfect is the enemy of the good. And I do believe that jurors have short attention spans, shorter every day.
I'm sorry, what were you saying?
Jurors have, thank you, very good, got me. And so demonstrative evidence is everything. You have to be showing them something every minute or two. And then you have to triage. You have to say what matters. This expert, you could put on this expert for 3 hours and it would be, you'd fully explain everything. Or you could do her in an hour and a half. You could do your client or, you know, a 776 in an hour and a half, or you could get to the frickin' point. You could call five witnesses to say the same thing, or you could just call one and you could just go from point to point to rest and make it flow. This case that we tried that was over nine.
Yamaha case you're talking about? Yep.
Yamaha case that's, you know, sort of burning in my mind right now. We had a judge who would go 3 days a week. There was another Yamaha case that had been tried by, I won't say who, that lasted 4 months, and they were going 5 days a week. And this person, I think, put on their case for two plus months.
The plaintiff's attorney did.
Their
case in chief was 2 months.
Yes. And they were proud of that. And it was, so 5 days a week. So let's say 20 days. And this case was every bit as complicated, if not more so, this one. And I said to the defense attorney, who's a very fine lawyer, Dan Rodman, very good. One of the best lawyers I've ever tried a case against. We're going in and I go, you know, our trial estimate for our case, not counting cross, is 6 days. And he was like, what are you talking about? I said, 6 days. And he was flabbergasted by that. He had to adapt significantly because he was smart enough to know that if we went 6 days, and his crosses were probably another 6 days. So our case ended up being about 12 days, but ours was only six. And then his was really long, but it would have been a lot longer even. He had to adapt and adjust, and it felt so good to be efficient. It felt so good. And at the same time, it was so hard. Andy's more anal than I am. Matt Davis was very helpful in sort of
big picture,
orchestrating big picture. And we were, you know, we were synergistic in our need to cut things down. But I always believed that. And I've not been as good at it until the last maybe 10 or 20 years because I was so afraid of leaving. You know, it's like taking a deposition. You know what you want. It's a little bit like that at trial by this time. Here's what's important. Here's what isn't. That kind of goes back to rule one, which is finish your opening, your closing argument, because that allows you to edit. You don't know where you're going and you're just sort of out there and you've got multiple theories and you're alternating, then you're a little bit lost. But if, you know, if you think about all three rules, and I haven't, they are synergistic in a way and they meld nicely and they all sort of speak toward, you know, thinking about the jury, thinking about who they are and the sacrifice that they're making. Being efficient for them, being organized for them. They love that. And not wasting their time.
Yeah. Juries are so smart. They're so perceptive.
100%.
When you start out, when you're younger, you're less experienced, you're nervous, you're going to leave stuff out. You want to overprove your case. And there's a fascinating study, and I will try to find it and put it in the show notes at some point. Basically, if it's a, let's say it's a red light, green light case, and you've got three witnesses who are all your way, right? Studies show if you call one witness, you're going to win that point. The more witnesses you call, the lesser chances you win. You're going to go because it's like, well, why is he calling so many witnesses on this simple little issue? It's hilarious.
Yeah. He must be defensive and worried about it. Now I'm going to be. That's a great point.
Final words of wisdom, Rich.
Oh, have fun. Don't take yourself too seriously. Take what you do really seriously. Enjoy the moment. There is, you know, having dabbled with all kinds of recreational drugs when I was younger. Listen, are my kids going to watch this? Probably not.
Are you suggesting you stop?
Yeah. But God dang it, there's no high greater than that 4:30 when you're coming back the next day. It is really living. You are alive. You are daring greatly. You are in the arena and you don't always win. And it freaking hurts when you don't, but you are alive. And so be proud of yourself for daring to get in there and do it. And I encourage more lawyers to just say, what the hell, man, take a swing. Take a swing and have fun while you're doing it. That is sort of a word of wisdom. Folks, when I am lucky enough to be on a trial team, we are going to have a good time. We are not going to sit there and wring our hands. And, you know, there'll be moments. I mean, moments where I was nervous as shit and pissed at myself for how I handled a witness. But the grand scheme of things, treat people well, have fun, and go for it. Those are my words.
Amazing. Rich Schoenberger, thanks for being a guest on Verdict Academy. And more importantly, thanks for being such a great mentor to our next generation of trial attorneys.
You're preaching to your choir, Kevin. You're the same and a phenomenal trial lawyer. So I'm feel privileged to be hanging with you.
Thank you for listening to Verdict Academy. If today's insights resonated with you, please subscribe and share with colleagues. In a world where we see each other less, learning from experienced trial lawyers matters now more than ever. Join us next time. Produced and powered by LawPods.